and I hope that some of the things that I'm concerned about turn out to be a straw man. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I agree with you on the antenna. Buying another antenna, first of all, it's going to be a little pricey. Raising it 10 foot, you might be able to do that more conveniently, or maybe move it to another area, which might make a difference. He may have, there may have been some new construction or something he's not aware of that's affecting it. But if it was me, I would try the elevation first before I would invest in the antenna, because there's no guarantee there. That for sure could be a wiki one. So, all right. Maybe I'll text him back and see what he wants to do, and maybe he'll have some more questions. Oh, by the way, Dick, I did post the new pictures on my QRZ. I didn't know if you saw the latest. They're all in there now.
I sure did, John. And by the way, I should have mentioned, I forgot that you had two questions there. One is if I stack a pair of antennas. Number two, if I raise it. Raising a aerial, raising any kind of an antenna on VHF, UHF, and even on HF frequencies, almost always gives you a benefit. You clear more trees. It's got more line of sight to the broadcast center. A little bit less multipath ratio, so to speak, compared to the direct signal. You almost always benefit with more altitude. Go for that. Yes, I saw those beautiful pictures. If anybody goes to KC2WGB's website, so to speak, QRZ.com, type in those call letters and look at his 15 pictures of the test equipment that John owns. I think John told us he's got something like 250 pieces of test equipment. I forget the number. Anything above 50 to me is just out of sight when it comes to pieces of test equipment. And the new pictures are a polar-like plot is the very first picture on his vector network analyzer, and another one is his McCroy scope with a square wave calibrator signal in there. Let me drop.
Dick, that first pattern on that vector network analyzer is called a charter pattern. I've never seen that one before.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that one. It is a kind of polar plot which is going to give you both amplitude and phase information simultaneously. If you take a look at, I'm trying to think of the name of the author of this book that was published in 1952 by Sperry Gyroscope. Microwave Transmission Techniques, I think is the name of it. I keep forgetting the author's name. It's a paperback book, and that diagram is in there. It's a method of describing the amplitude and phase characteristic of an unknown loading device. So it's a kind of polar plot with a peculiar zero centers. The desirable spot is not necessarily the center of the chart, depending on what you're trying to do. So I'm not as familiar with that chart. But on your LaCroix picture, you've got a square wave calibrator signal, and you'll notice that the square wave calibrator signal, the upper flat top and the lower flat top portion of the square wave is tilted. That tells me one of two things is happening. Let me drop it.
Spaceship from the generator.
No, it is dispersion. That is the picture of dispersion when you're doing a calibration. If you use the real square wave calibrator that many a scope has, you connect your scope probe to it. And if the scope probe has it's a 10-to-1 scope probe and it's got a variable capacitor adjustment characteristic, you're either turning the tip of the scope probe or you're adjusting a screw back at the BNC connector at the front panel. In either case, when you calibrate your scope probe while looking at the square wave signal of the calibrated function of the scope, as you've got the capacitor set too low, you'll get the slant that you've seen, downward slanting. So that's one way you can get it. Or if you take a pure 50-ohm coaxial cable from a square wave generator and plug it straight into the scope without setting the scope in the 50-ohm load mode, you'll get that picture. Now you're looking at the full capacitance of the PNC cable, if you know what I mean. So that slight slant you're seeing is a lack of calibration. It is showing you a low frequency emphasis, dispersion of the way you connected the two together. It's a beautiful looking curve, but to a person who knows what a calibration curve should look like, where the flat top should be completely flat, there's a slight error there, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
that is a mystery, because that phase shift is not something that can be compensated, because those LaCroix probes don't have an adjustment on them, and they are 10 times 10 probes, but the Tektronix has it. So that I'm looking into, why those probes, those are brand new probes that I just received, I got four of them, and the old ones didn't do that, so I have to find out what's going on there. But a lot of fun. And then down below, oh, by the way, on that chart diagram, the waveform looks exactly the same as it would if you switched it over to Smith chart. It doesn't change the waveform, only the information for looking at the hard numbers. That's the only difference. And if you get down a couple of pictures, then you see it functioning as a Smith chart.
Yeah, I think it's a different method of display of similar information. Smith chart-like information. A Smith chart, by the way, really is a polar plot of the reflected signal. And by way of the grid line set up in a particular way, we call it a Smith chart. And there's other ways you can set it up where it becomes an amplitude phase diagram. And this third kind of quasi-polar plot that you've got there is giving you other information about phase and amplitude characteristics of the signal you're looking at. It's not a popular one, but in Marino, that's the name of the book I'm trying to think of. Marino is the book on microwave transmission techniques, microwave transmission line techniques, I think is the name of it. Marino is a very good book that has that chart in it. And when I get a chance, I'm going to look it up in Marino, because he's giving me an explanation. He is showing you that chart as to one of the intermediate steps that was done in the 1930 time frame as they were developing the Smith chart. There was a whole lot of charting techniques that were invented, which eventually ended up with the one that won the prize, so to speak, when Mr. Smith in New Jersey, I think he was working at Bell Labs at the time, invented the Smith chart, and that has become the industry standard. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, it was quite a project rearranging all of those things. I spent 3 or 4 days in there and then had to do the photography. I got to get the focusing issue solved with that too, but I had so many requests, and I've gotten a few emails to describe some of the equipment, going back and forth with that. Well, that's it for the mailbag, Dick. Let's go over to Paul, see what he's got for us. That's new. Thank you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Where's your 2-meter rate, John? I'm looking for it.
That's in the shack. The shack, there's two rooms. One is just the lab with those pieces, the pile of equipment, and then I've got the all the Kenwoods, all the transceivers in one room.
Believe I'm looking through this thing. Very good. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, he's down to his last two laboratories. But I keep forgetting the number, John. Approximately the number of pieces of test equipment you own. What's that approximate number, John? Over to you, K2IRW.
The total is about 400. In the lab, there is about, you were close, I think it's 220 pieces.
Wow. And I know you were getting a nice conversation today from Vito on his new grid dip oscillator, grid dip meter. And I think you already own two or three of those. Is that true, John?
Yes, I have a Millen somewhere. It's the older model, though, not the nice one that Vito has, but I have one made by McGraw-Edison, which is called a measurements unit, and it has individual plug-in heads, remote unit, that was on the photos there somewhere, but that is an excellent unit. It has a head for HF, one for VHF, and then one for UHF. Beautiful instrument. Old, but works perfectly. Yeah, I've maybe four of them.
I was listening to one of our past TechNets of about 2 weeks ago, Paul, and you mentioned the lady's name who is in the Biosphere 2. She calls it Biosphere 2 because the Earth that we live on, she calls it Biosphere number 1, and this 3.14-acre facility in Arizona that on two occasions for a year or two at a time, eight people were dwelling in it, and they wanted it to be a completely self-sustained sealed unit. This is a hothouse-like structure, but it's a lot more modern, biosphere number two. And they wanted the plants to be generating the oxygen, the animals to be generating the food, the farm to be making the food, and so on. They wanted it to be a completely closed system. And all of a sudden, they were running on 14.5% oxygen instead of 21% oxygen, and they were getting some real grief over that. And so a few tons of oxygen in this facility slowly disappeared over the first year, and they suddenly discovered that the brand new concrete they had put in the structure when they built it, as the concrete cured, it was absorbing oxygen from the air, locking it up into the concrete, taking it away from the people. And so the experiment, some people think it was a failure. The whole reason you run an experiment, let me drop this. The whole reason you run an experiment is to test something you're not sure about, to confirm a theory. It's a proof of concept, if you know what I mean. Everyone wants to believe that we can make a self-sustaining situation as long as you've got enough sunlight that can shine through the windows without removing the ultraviolet to keep the plants happy. Some of the problem they had is that the plants were not getting the normal amount of wind, and therefore the plant was not building up the structures. Your trees were not building up the normal structure because they weren't getting wind. The plants were not getting as much photosynthesis because some of the ultraviolet was being filtered out by, even though they used very high quality glass. And so all good experiments are going to give you some surprises. If you absolutely positively knew everything's going to happen, you wouldn't have to run the experiment. So from that point of view, from my point of view, it was a success. They learned a lot of information about a self-sustaining situation of a biosphere. And so it's still possible, but you got to work a little harder and you got to worry about some of these details. And I forget that lady's name. I went to her website and saw quite a few of her displays. She also gave a TED discussion on what happened. And there's also another lady you can see that I ran into in the same search. Let me drop it. This lady from South Africa that's describing the selecting process, where they started off with 200,000 volunteers who want to go on a one-way trip to Mars. And they've selected the 200,000 down to 70, and eventually going to come down to a much smaller number. And so she's got about a one-hour YouTube video describing what she thinks is the advantage of doing that, and she wants to do it. And as you know, I think very few people would want to go to a place that is so severe. I mean, Mars has an average temperature of something like minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit as an average. It's got much higher and much lower temperatures at different conditions. It's got very little air pressure. It's got very little oxygen. It's got no magnetic field. It's got no atmosphere. So therefore, you're going to get a lot of ultraviolet. You're going to get a lot of cosmic ray bombardment. Without the magnetic field, you're going to be hit with a lot of solar wind particles. It's really not a place to take a vacation. And to go there for the rest of your life and not have any capability of coming back, and might not even survive to get there. It's nice to have a pioneering spirit, but this is way above and beyond normal pioneering by my standards. Now, over you, Paul, for any comments on all of the above. WS2N with the Space Report. K2IW in the deck, man. You got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Very good. It's one of my favorite stories. That's Jane Poynter. She comes out of England, and she got involved with these people. She was very young, and spent a lot of time doing other things. You know, they were on a ship for months at a time. It was like an ecology adventure, you might say. And spent there probably a year in the middle of nowhere in Australia. And it was all funded by this rich guy that believed in all those kinds of way out experiments. And then he wound up funding the Biosphere 2 project. And her name is Jane Poynter. And she's one of the people that she was in there with is Tabor McCollum. And Tabor was eventually became her husband soon after they got out of the biosphere. So, you know, you might enjoy the book. It's a hard book to get to. Not a hard book, but, you know, a lot of libraries don't have it. You might have to tell them that you want to get it, and they'll get it for you. Let me drop it. It's called 2 Years and 20 Minutes. And you can figure out the name of the book. That's how long she was in there, 2 years. And then couldn't really get out of there fast enough, waiting for the end. And there was a speech by Jane, the one with the, she's an ecologist, I forgot her name. She was involved with the monkeys and everything. She was giving a speech, and the speech was dragging out, and they stated it 20 minutes longer than they really wanted to. Jane Goodall. But it's, you know, one of these books that are, you know, really true. I like books like that. Piece of history, but very well written. How they got there, everything that went on inside the biosphere too. Selection process, what went on afterwards. Very, very good book. It talks about the oxygen and everything. And it really was designed for, you know, to see if everything could be self-contained. But the one thing that they planned on doing would have been too expensive was, you know, a million solar cells outside. So they just used outside commercial electricity to run equipment. So they did do that. They had equipment to pump down the carbon dioxide and things of that nature. But theoretically, you know, here's this gigantic 3.5 acre place that you could put into space with the sun shining on you, and you know you're going to create all this habitat with animals inside and everything like that. I mean, it's, how long could you really live like this? And they did it for 2 years. So you might enjoy that book, Dick. Today, she and her husband run a company called Paragon. And they've helped out NASA for many years, you know, with the space station. They've designed experiments that are done and presently being done on the space station. They're designing futuristic spacesuits. NASA wants to get involved. They can for any of the private companies further down the road. You know, they're very, you know, they know how to take a spacesuit and make it very efficient. You know, use up every little bit of oxygen. You know, the water, the heating system, the cooling system. They're very good at that. And now they have a company that's spun off from them. It's part of the same group called Worldview. Worldview has designed a balloon, and they've already launched these balloons. They're helium-filled balloons, and they're going to be as big as a football stadium. And at the bottom, they plan on carrying a capsule-like piece of equipment where you can put 8 people inside. A pilot and co-pilot and 6 tourists, and you'll be in a shirt and sleeve environment, go all the way up to you know, like 20 miles high, and then you're hanging from this paraglider that's attached to the balloon. And at some point they'll probably load a balloon first, you know, as far as they can go, and then eventually cut that paraglider loose, and you'll float all the way down on a parasail all the way down to Earth. You know, it'll be an experience where you can see the curvature of the Earth. You know, you won't get any microgravity experience that, you know, some of these other rocket people are involved with. But you'll have a good couple hours ride up, and maybe, you know, another hour or so down to land on the ground. You know, you might have a 5 or 6 hour experience compared to, say, a suborbital flight that X-Corps is putting out. you'll be able to go for this ride for on a balloon for $70,000. So the, you know, the bathroom's in this capsule, windows all over everywhere, and a pilot and co-pilot. That's all I know about the Jane Pointer story. You should check out her book. It doesn't have the last piece of information in it. You know, that's all late. Happened in the last decade or two. That book is worth reading, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, when I went to the, when I Googled the word Jane Pointer, and I saw a number of the articles written by her and for her, and about her and by her, and also went to the TED Talk, she described what it was like being in that biosphere for 2 years and 20 minutes, that how hard she had to work in order to be doing the gardening, so to speak, let's call it the farming, in order to make the food, to try to keep the oxygen levels up. So she had to work very hard, but she was in a rather pristine environment, visiting the rest of her family through the window periodically. And after 2 years and 20 minutes, she was let out of that biosphere for the first time. And her first impressions, let me drop this. Coming back to her family members and friends for the first time in 2 years, the first impression is, boy, they had strong smells. I mean, she was living in a rather pure environment, and she came out to people who were using deodorants and soaps and antiperspirants and whatever. People, from her point of view, have an awful lot of strong smell. Her exact wording is, boy, they stank. They stunk. All of her friends and relatives didn't smell good. One other crazy subject is when it comes to the people volunteering on this one-way trip to Mars, where there's probably going to be an equal number of males and females. People who volunteer for that mission have to volunteer to never have sex. And the reason for that is all of the facilities that are going to be supplied on Mars do not have any ability to take care of children. You don't have children-sized spacesuits. And a child grows so fast, you couldn't be making that number of spacesuits, if you know what I mean. So you have to make sure there's no children. You're going on a one-way trip. You're never going to come home. You're living in this severe environment, and that's the rest of your life. Most of us think we want to accomplish something with our life, learn certain things, get certain degrees, earn a certain amount of money, get a certain amount of financial security so you can retire, travel, meet people, and so on. And a hell of a lot of those things you've got to give up when you volunteer for this Mars mission.
You know what that means, don't you, Dick?
Tell me what it means, John. Go ahead.
The obligations or vasectomies.
Okay, so what you're saying is that these people volunteering for Mars are going to also have to volunteer for certain operations to make sure there are no children. It's a little too much dedication, but they're admitting up front that the financing is going to be difficult. It's going to take an awful lot of money to establish it, to maintain it, and so on. Will these people that are placed on Mars really be completely self-sustaining, growing their own food, finding their own water, making their own fuel, making their own oxygen, and so on, from the resources of Mars, which is an extremely severe environment? From my point of view, you and I know what a real desert is. I've spent some time in the Mojave Desert of California. I've read articles of what it's like in the Atacama Desert of Chile. Really severe places. And Mars is 10 times more severe than that. In the case of the Atacama Desert, it's so extremely dry, like, you know, 3% humidity. Let me drop this. If you're not consuming something like 3 or 4 liters of water every day, if you're not working, if you're working hard, you got to consume a lot more than that. You know, your body will become dehydrated and it's game over in about 1 day. I mean, and that's on Earth. And this Mars mission is 10 or 100 times more severe than that. I have some understanding for pioneering spirit, but I think this is beyond the point of pioneering. It is well in the threshold of crazy, by my standards. Over to you, Paul. I guarantee Paul would not volunteer for this. There's a hell of a lot of other space reports he wants to be able to read. And by the way, yes, they will have communication back to Earth, but at various times you're going to get a considerable delay time on the conversation because of the speed of light and the couple of hundred million miles that exist between Earth and Mars during certain portions of their orbits. WS2N, K2RIW, give us some good news about this ball, or the exciting parts.
Even if I could send a SpaceNet report from Mars, Dick, I'm not gonna go. There's no Burger King on Mars. I tell you, it's the old story of looking through the Mars Global Surveyor or the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter telescopes. They looked at the surface. Well, at least they found, you know, some kind of possible water that's moving around on Mars. But there's still no cows and no birds. You can't even get a chicken sandwich. So I'm not going. But it's not going to stop people from doing it. They'll be lined up, you know, with their tickets in their hand if they start shooting them off, you know, 100 at a time. Like, SpaceX wants to do thousands and thousands of people. And they better bring some small spacesuits because I know somehow somebody's going to get past this whole no baby thing. And what good is sending thousands of people there if you're not going to have any kids? You got to have the first Martian, you know, born there, just like they had in Virginia. But, you know, it could happen. You know, you have... you know, when we came to America, it didn't take long for, you know, you had Columbus and his ships, and then next thing you know, you had dozens of more ships, and all kinds of people going to Plymouth, and they would spend months and months at sea, you know, 4 or 5 months at a time, floating in the ocean with nothing but the wind behind them to get them here. So how different is that than getting into a spaceship and spending months and months at a time to get to Mars? I mean, it's not going to happen for a long time, but someday, 100 years from now, maybe you'll see it. And if Elon Musk has his way, he'll beat NASA to Mars. Yeah, that's his goal, SpaceX. No, I'm not going to be going anytime soon, Dick. I'd be happy to go on the bottom of the comet. I think that's around $5,000. I think Elon Musk wants $500,000 to get to Mars.
When Columbus went to the United States, when he went to the Western world, so to speak, he was reasonably guaranteed that when he got there, there would be the right amount of sunlight, the right amount of air pressure, the right amount of oxygen, the right amount of water, the potential for food, a reasonable amount of gravity, doesn't require a spacesuit. There's a hell of a lot of things that were sort of guaranteed that we all take for granted. The tons of material, I'm talking about water, food, and air, the tons of material required to sustain one human being for 1 year. As approximately the volume of your house and roughly the mass of your house. That's how much material it takes to sustain you for a year, and we take that for granted. Don't realize that every one of the breaths that we breathe out, somebody else is going to re-breathe that air, so to speak. It's all recycled. In space and Mars, that doesn't take place. By way of all of your liquid and solid waste products that come out of your body, over the next 100 years, this Earth will recycle all of that. It'll come back as plants and eventually as food. To do that artificially, without the Earth and without Mother Nature, wow. I mean, the words roll off the tongue very easily. You can write articles on paper making it sound easy to really do it. A human being... You're alive right now and you're consuming an amount of food, oxygen, and water that's creating continuous metabolism at the rate of 130 watts. you are generating 130 watts of thermal energy inside of your body.
Repeater, time out.
130 watts of thermal energy, 24/7. Every minute, every hour, every day, every year that you live, 130 watts of thermal energy is coming out of your body by way of the metabolism that keeps you alive, that keeps that heart beating and keeps that brain working and keeps that digestive system working. 130 watts per human. The energy has got to come from somewhere. It's coming from the food and the oxygen and the air that you're breathing and the water that you're drinking. And continuous flow of materials must happen through the body to maintain that 130 watts. That's if you're just sitting idly in a theater seat. If you're doing hard labor, a person doing a marathon is running three times or four times that amount of watts of continuous thermal generation and energy consumption. We forget about these details. Over to you, Paul.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
I look at it in a simple way. Look at what we're trying to do here on Earth with reverse osmosis or desalinization. We can't even do that at a rate that we need. And that's really basically very simple to do compared to what you're speaking about on Mars. So it's going to be extremely difficult, and I don't give them much of a chance. Not if they're going to send big groups up there, and even if they send bio units up there ahead of time and have them land and have everything manufactured ready to go, it's still going to be an adventure for sure. Back to you, Dick.
Let me see if I have it.
I'm going to add a couple more words. I'm going to give you a couple more words of what I was saying. A watt of energy for 1 second is 1 joule. A joule is a significant amount of stored energy. When you run that defibrillator full blast on a human being who's had a cardiac arrest, and you set that for a couple of joules, and you blast that human being with that couple of joules, your body is generating 130 watts, 130 joules of energy every single second is being generated by your body 24/7. That energy's got to come from somewhere. All that raw materials that you eat and drink and breathe has to continuously be there with no interruption. And you're always, on Mars, you're always going to be fighting the freeze. A human being can live for 3 minutes without air. He can live for 3 days without food or without water. And you can live for, I think it's 3 weeks without food. You violate any of those threes, and you're probably game over. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yes, I've heard that before. Any of the three that you talked about, you have to manage to bring this all with you, and then when you get there, make sure it stays there for as long as you live on Mars. I was going to mention, there's plenty of people with plenty of money now. I mean, all these billionaires have actually paid to go on the International Space Station. We talked about that last week or the week before. And, by the way, one guy I thought was up there for two trips, Owen Garriott's son, Richard Garriott, he was up there for once. There was another guy, from Microsoft, he paid to go up twice, and that was Charles Simone. And, there's actually been 8 flights, so and 7 different people that have done this, including one woman, and they've all paid Russians, anywhere between $25 and $40 million to take this ride. And you asked about the length. That was last week. The longest length. Simone was up there for 14 days, and another time for probably 15 days. So roughly 2 weeks at a time. Some of them have been up there for less time. Usually around 8 days, 10 days. But here's these guys that have the money. Now you can imagine, there are now seats on the Mars colony transport going to Mars, and who wants to go? Well, the richest people.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Money and guts. This guy, Branson. Went around the world or something on a balloon. He's a billionaire. He's going to stick their neck out. And I don't think there's going to be any shortage of people to do it. So, the technical problems, once you talk about feeding the people, water, oxygen, power, once that's all overcome, I don't think you're going to have a shortage of people that are willing to do this. Same for the moon. If they decide to colonize the moon, you'll have people standing online fighting each other to get on a rocket. So, who knows, Dick. I might have done the moon when I was younger. But, you know you're going to come back. You're only 3-4 days away. You know, you're going to get there. You're going to spend years there before you're going to come back. Now, NASA's come up with a plan to do this, and now they're talking about the late 2030s. It only came out last week. That was part of my space report. They're going to take at least 30 rockets before they, you know, we're talking about the big rocket, the SLS, Space Launch System. At least 30 versions of, you know, those rockets, different types, going up and, you know, setting up, you know, all these equipment on Mars before anybody ever lands there. Maybe even doing a landing on one of the Mars moons. It's going to take a long time, and at an average rate of 1 or 2 per year, 1 or 2 bites per year, it's not going to, you know, it's going to take forever. Maybe into 2040. That's why I think Elon Musk has a better shot. There's nothing going to stop him. Back to you, Dick.
The goal itself is a bit crazy. However, very similar to what happened with the Apollo lunar program. If you wanted to be extremely severe, you can say the purpose of that program was not only to teach a lesson to the Russians that we've got a lot of technology, even though they were the first to launch a satellite and the first to put a man in space and the first to do a spacewalk. They had a number of firsts, and we had to do a catch-up and show them that, hey, we've got some technology too. So that was one of our motivations. And if you want to, again, be very severe, you can say we wanted to get some samples of lunar soil back here to study the origin, the past history of the moon. And we paid $33 billion roughly to do that. Spent 10 years and hundreds of thousands of people on that project. A worthwhile project. Let me drop. Because in the process of achieving that really crazy goal, we developed some very good computing hardware, thermal protection hardware, medical testing hardware, display devices, calculations for rocketry and astrodynamics, radio astronomy, optical astronomy, a hell of a lot of things had a significant advance. I mean, during World War II, for reasons of fear of being overcome by the Axis powers, we did an awful lot of very good, very fast research on microwave tubes and radars and radios and so on, and computers. So each of these goals have a whole lot of technical details, and those technical details, once they're achieved, we drop. Society gets continuous benefit out of those achievements for the rest of the history of society. So the process of achieving the goal, real good things happen. So in the process of people preparing for a Mars mission, doing all the things required to give you the ability to do that, a lot of benefits going to happen out of that. And almost everything NASA does has a fallout of roughly 5-to-1. I mean, every dollar you spend in NASA gives you $5 worth of benefit for the rest of society, for the rest of mankind, so to speak. So it's an extremely good investment. And when you think you're wasting your money to do space research, but you're putting your own people to work. That supplies salaries, that supplies education, that supplies houses, supplies all kinds of good things. So it's not a waste. It isn't just the X number of pounds of dirt that we brought back. So preparing for Mars is a good thing. To go there is mildly crazy. Wow. It's almost is a waste of the rest of your life. There's a certain amount of things you can accomplish in your life. Can you really accomplish them on Mars? I don't think so. But that's me. I've got a little bit of pioneering spirit, but not that much, Paul. So, of all the people listening to us tonight, if we did a survey, I'd be hard-pressed to think that any one person listening would immediately volunteer for this one-way mission to Mars for the rest of their life. But that's an opinion. What's your opinion on that? I'm going to pass it to John first and then to Paul in that order. KC2WGB. How many people in our listening audience do you think would volunteer for this, John? You got it, John.
Not many, Dick. I don't believe... I don't know anybody. I have some pretty wild friends, but I don't think any of them have ever thought about going to Mars themselves. They look forward to it, that people are going to go, but that risk is just too high. I would say maybe a tenth of a percent, possibly, of the population might actually, you know, sign up, and then whoever gets voted out. I don't think there'd be too many, Dick, in my opinion. KC2WGB, back to you, sir.
Okay, John just gave us a wag, a wild-ass guess, of a tenth of a percent. That's one person per thousand. I don't think it's that high. If I had to make a guess, I think it's closer to one person per 10,000, one person per 100,000, in that order. When it comes to crazy things, you've got one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. Among the really serious microwave guys, the guys that go to the microwave update, guys that are on 22 gigahertz and 47 gigahertz and 241 gigahertz, there's a couple of them per 500 hams. So a couple of them per 500 hams, and the hams are 1 per 500 in the general population. I'm talking about 4 or 5 people per million that fall into that category of the real serious microwave researcher, willing to build his own equipment and willing to do QSOs at 47 gigahertz and try to break distance records and do it with moon bounds and so on. That's the extreme pioneering spirit that I know of in the ham radio world. And so would that percentage of people be willing to volunteer for Mars? I don't know. But the OS2N, what's your guess as to what percentage of the population would volunteer for this poll? You got a poll, K2LIW.
Oh, I would say probably, when they first heard about it, maybe 1 out of 100,000. And then once they hear all the information that we're talking about here and really find out what's going on, you're going to drop to 1 to 1 million. That's why anything this guy... got his name, comes out of the Netherlands, Mars One, setting this whole thing up where he's going to send, you know, people to Mars, and they're not going to come back, 4 people, and then another 4 people 2 years later, and so on and so forth. You know, he's just, I think this guy's just whistling Dixie, hoping that people just send him money. There was application fees and all of that. In fact, the leaders of China told the China citizens, you know, do not sign up with this guy. And he, so far, he's raised very little money. He doesn't have a spaceship. He doesn't have a launch facility. He has nothing. I mean, he's got absolutely nothing. Telling people he was going to use SpaceX to get there. You know... There's no signed agreements with anybody, and yet he's got these people coming out of the blue handing over $37 for an application, you know. So maybe he's up a couple $100,000. I just don't, you know, I don't see it happening. But NASA, you know, that's different. They're serious about doing this. And plans that they have, I think, could be a little bit more direct. Have like the ARM mission, the asteroid rendezvous, asteroid relocate, I think, mission. And they want to go out and grab an asteroid and put it into lunar orbit. And then after doing that, you know, with remotely, and then send the crew up there eventually to dock with this thing and take a couple of pieces off of it and bring it back. I think, I mean, it's something to do, but I think they're getting sidetracked. They should be a little bit more focused on the direction that they want to go instead of just bringing rocks back and putting them around moon orbit. You know, they should be concentrating more on getting funding for some kind of habitat module, or maybe two of them, to attach to an Orion spacecraft so that they can, you know, have plenty of room for people to live for 6 to 8 months just to get to Mars, and never mind them, you know, the trip back. You know, they know what they want. They've got designs, but, you know, there's no funding for that right now. So, we're going to be talking about this for many years to come, Dick. Back to you. This is WS Plan.
KC2FYJ.
KC2FYJ, I think it was. Give me your call one more time. FYJ, and your name. I should know you. Go right ahead with your name, and then your comments, sir.
It's Harry, KC2FYJ, and I'm on Echo Link. I just would point out that signing up for a mission to Mars might really be considered in this day and age not too much different than signing up for an overseas voyage from Europe westward in the 1400s and 1500s when they didn't know what was there. And even once they did know what was there, signing up to come over to America, hey, that was a one-way ticket, and lots of people did it for lots of reasons. There's no reason to believe that once the technology is there to do it, people wouldn't sign up to go to Mars for similar kinds of motivation.
Agree with that, Dick.
Or disagree?
Yeah, I can tell that Wes disagrees and I disagree. We're glossing over some very severe minor details, major details. When you volunteered, when Columbus volunteered to get on that ship and go to the United States, yeah, there were people who had a theory you're going to fall off the edge of the earth. But you had a reasonably strong guarantee that there would be air there. There would be sunlight there. There would be a reasonable temperature there. There would be water there. There would be food there. There would be plants. There'd be animals. There may be other natives. Going to a place that's very foreign, but it's nowhere near as foreign as the one we're talking about. If you want to read some more of the details, there is a fun book. It's called Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. It's published in 2010. It's published by, I think it's W.W. Nostrand Company. Rather well done book. Not because the subject is so desirable, packing and going to Mars. This is a very skilled writer who has a lot of inside information with NASA. And the book itself was given these following reports. Newsweek said, funny, inquisitive, uncovered by experts, Roach is the general reader's ideal emissary to the arcane of serious science. That's what Newsweek said. Dumb Repose said, Mary Roach is one of an endangered species, a science writer with a sense of humor. She, by the way, also wrote a book called Stiff, in which she's literally talking about the male organ and made comedy out of it and gave you a lot of specific information. New York Times Book Review said, Roach is a wonderful, vivid writer, a celebration of the wide, occasionally crazy spectrum of human pursuit. New Yorker said, the funniest science writer in the country.
Repeater, time out.
The Seattle Times said, Roach is an authoritative, endlessly curious, and drolly funny. Her search is scrupulous and winningly presented. So it's a well-written book, and I'm pretty sure that Paul has written Mary Roach's book called Packing for Mars. So you'll get more specific information about the pioneering spirit really running crazy, but she with her NASA experience, can tell you a little bit more what an astronaut really goes through, what it's really like to be part of the NASA program. We see the very... Let me drop.
I read that book. A very good book, but I still agree with Harry, the guy from IRLP.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you in a minute, Paul. We see the very desirable portion of an Apollo mission, a Gemini mission, a Mercury mission. We see the high points, we see the good parts. We saw Neil Armstrong first put his foot on the moon and say those famous words. But the real details of what goes on behind the scenes, Mary Roach gives you some of those details. So what was your impression of Packing for Mars? What part of the book struck you most striking, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, and the Tech Man?
Yeah, that was a very good book. Well, her insight, because she was and got involved with all the people that used to work with all the astronauts and what's involved and everything from the food to the spacesuits, bathroom problems, breathing. You know, the details that came out of the book was, you know, very good. What's involved in just space travel, the complexity of it, and then you extrapolate that to Mars, it's quite a big thing. But, you know, as far as, you know, that's what I was trying to say before, when I think his name was Harry. You know, people were leaving Europe with no plans of coming back. I mean, they were being persecuted with their religion and everything, and that they were leaving, and that's it. From, you know, from the 1400s all the way to the 1600s and beyond, the possibility of maybe their ship going down. Sure, they knew there was water probably here and food and things like that, but, you know, those provisions will be taken care of. Once that's all taken care of, you're going to have people that will sign up for this. They said that with the astronauts, you know, just to get into that capsule in the 1960s, you know, no, thinking that thing could blow up, or many of them did. You know, they used to watch them go up and explode, and yet they got in there. Back to you, Dick.
Go right ahead, John, and then I'm going to read the flyleaf of this book, which has also got some exciting info. You got it, John.
Dick, I wonder what you think of the level head view. If you were to look at, let's say, Lloyd's of London, the actuaries, do you think they would underwrite a flight? What do you think about that? Back to you, Dick.
I think you're saying if Lloyd's of London still exists, would they insure an astronaut on a flight to Mars? Is that sort of what you're asking, John? Now go ahead.
Yes, like when they would underwrite the ships that came across the ocean. They did that very well. Those actuaries they had were basically geniuses. I wonder what their opinion of a successful flight would be and what the numbers would be. Might be so astronomical they wouldn't even take a chance.
Yeah, when it comes to very, very risky endeavors, the premium for that insurance policy becomes so high, really gain anything by having that insurance at all. I'm trying to remember now, there was a comparison given recently. There's quite a few people who will take flight insurance when they're going to take an air trip. And the chances of running into a disaster on an airliner is something like 1 per 200 million, whereas the chances of the Earth being hit by an asteroid and all of society being wiped out is nowhere near as high as that. And yet, we think the asteroid is something that's never going to happen to us, and so on. So people's risk assessment at times is pretty strange. A high percentage of the population will say, I do not want a nuclear power station in my county. It's much too dangerous. And yet some of those exact same people will drive their child to school in an automobile and not worry about connecting the seatbelt. And there's a huge difference in the risk between those two. Let me read what was written in the flyleaf of this book entitled Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. Stand by. She said, space is a world devoid of all the things we need to live and thrive, such as air, gravity, hot showers, fresh produce, privacy, deer. Space exploration is in some ways an exploration of what it means to be human. How much can a person give up? How much weirdness can they take? What happens to you when you can't walk for a year, have sex, smell flowers? What happens if you vomit in your helmet during a spacewalk? Is it possible for a human body to survive a bailout from space? To answer these questions, space agencies set up all manner of quizzical and strangely bizarre space simulations. As Mary Roach discovers, it is possible to preview space without ever leaving Earth. From the space shuttle training toilet to a crash test of NASA's new space capsule, cadaver filling in for an astronaut, how about that, in parentheses, Roach takes us on a surreal, entertaining trip into science of life in space and space on Earth. Now, let me review one of these things. I saw a documentary somewhere about the training that an astronaut, male or female, has to go through in order to be able to properly use the toilet on the International Space Station. Let me drop. There literally is a camera inside of the toilet, and you have to properly position portions of your body over the correct portion of that space toilet in order for it to work correctly in weightlessness. And if you get it wrong, some fairly nasty waste products are going to be drifting through the air, and it may not be captured fast enough for everybody to not be awfully angry with you. And so she went into a description of that. Just learning to use the toilet on the International Space Station, that in itself requires an amazing amount of training, and it's quite a turmoil. I don't know who wants to pick up on any of this. Give me your call. This is K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay, yeah. Did tell us, let's see now, is one of the Mars orbiters that is taking very high resolution pictures that discovered this extremely brackish, they have reason to believe it's very brackish, water-like material that is flowing down the sides of the hill on Mars. So Mars does have some water. Boy, that's far from the ingredients you and I need. Is the water, is there enough of it in the right spot with enough availability? And how much resources are required to get rid of that extremely excess salt in this very briny solution to get down to the real fluid and then do, I can't think of the name of the process now, where you separate oxygen and hydrogen from water in order to electrolysis, in order to do the electrolysis, to separate the two to be able to use the oxygen for breathing and the hydrogen for fuel and so on. And by the way, even using hydrogen for fuel is only half the step. I mean, if you and I have a tank full of hydrogen on the Earth, we take for granted that we can light the hydrogen we got a flame. In space, you don't only supply the fuel, you've got to supply the oxygen to make the flame. You've got to supply the container to hold those reactant materials together. In the vacuum of space, it's not going to work. There's a hell of a lot of things we take for granted. So I think it's one of the Mars orbiters that it found this good news. But that's not quite good enough news to keep me completely happy, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW, the TechNet.
You're a pessimist.
Yes, I am.
If I have it. Okay, yeah, that's the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter deck, MRO. And it has cameras on board, you know, the high-rise camera. That's a very large telescope. That I think it looks like it's about 300 millimeter diameter, or whatever. It's a large camera that looks down at it. It takes high definition pictures of the surface, and it's done around 2 or 3% of the whole planet since 2004. It's been up, you know, in orbit for a little over 10 years now. So it's doing a good job, but it also has a spectrometer on board called Chrism. Instead of the word prism, it's Chrism with a C. And that can detect exactly what kind of